sermon will be on the Lord's Day 3. The theme of Lord's Day 3 is the total depravity. And then we will read a passage that actually reflects the doctrine really, really well. I should say the Lord's Day 3 reflects the doctrine of the Bible of total depravity. Judges chapter 21, the last chapter of Judges. Before we get into there, I must say that Judges chapter 21 is one story, but it is the continuation of the whole story, which started from Judges 19. So without really knowing that Judges 19 is, you can still see how depraved the people are by reading the one chapter, Judges 21, but it helps you better and more if you read through Judges 19, which I'm not going to do. I will mention that in a sermon extensively, because that is very important to understand Judges chapter 21. But we'll read the final comment of the author of the book of Judges, which comes at the last verse of the book. But we'll start from verse 13. Then the whole congregation sent word to the children of Benjamin, who were at the rock of Rimmon, and announced the peace to them. So Benjamin came back at the time, and they gave them the women whom they had saved alive of the women of Jabesh Gilead. Yet they had not found enough for them. And the people grieved for Benjamin, because the Lord had made a void in the tribes of Israel. Then the elders of the congregation said, "What shall we do for wives for those who remain, since the women of Benjamin have been destroyed?" And they said, "There must be an inheritance for the survivors of the Benjamin, that a tribe may not be destroyed from Israel. However, we cannot give them wives from our daughters, for the children of Israel have sworn an oath, saying, 'Cursed be the one who gives a wife to a Benjamin.'" Then they said, "In fact, there is a yearly feast of the Lord in Shiloh, which is north of Bethel, on the east side of a highway that goes up from Bethel to Shechem and south of Libona. Therefore they instructed the children of Benjamin, saying, 'Go lie in wait in the vineyards and watch, and just when the daughters of Shiloh come out to perform their dances, then come out from the vineyards, and every man catch a wife for himself from the daughters of Shiloh, then go to the land of Benjamin. Then it shall be, when their fathers or their brothers come to us to complain, that we will say to them, 'Be kind to them for our sake, because we did not take a wife for any of them in the war. For it is not as though you have given the women to them at this time, making yourselves guilty of your oath.' Then the children of Benjamin did so. They took enough wives for their number from those who danced, whom they caught. Then they went and returned to their inheritance, and they rebuilt the cities and dwelt in them. So the children of Israel departed from there. At the time, every man to his tribe and family, they went out from there, every man to his inheritance. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes." The confessional reading comes from Lord's Day 3. Heidelberg Catechism, Lord's Day 3. Lord's Day 3, question and answer is number 6. Did God create man so wicked and perverse? No. God created man good and in his own image, that is, in true righteousness and holiness, so that he might truly know God his creator, love him with all his heart, and live with God in eternal happiness for his praise and glory. So if I may pause here, when God created man and woman, he created man and woman good and in his own image. You see that right away in Genesis. When God gave woman to man, Adam said, "Surely she'll be called Eve," right? Because she's out of man. And then surely she is bone of my bones. And there's a beautiful confession appreciating God's greatness. Right? There's goodness, whereas very contrast to what we read today. Rather than snatching the woman from the dancing party like a beast, there's a huge contrast that's what sin does to man. Question answer number 7. Then where does man's corrupt nature come from? From the fall and disobedience of our first parents, Adam and Eve, in paradise. This fall has so poisoned our nature that we are all conceived and born in sin. We're going to see that in the sermon. Question answer number 8. But are we so corrupt that we are totally unable to do any good and inclined toward all evil? Yes, unless we are born again by the Spirit of God. John chapter 3, verse 3 to 5, the footnote says. If you please, please keep your open Bible open. I'm going to go through just survey throughout from chapter 19 to 21. It'll be helpful if you just follow through if you can. Beloved in the Lord, do you know the expression? Do you know the expression called the butterfly effect? So when a butterfly flaps its wings, there's an expression, when a butterfly flaps its wings in California, and there will be an effect, and an effect will cross the Pacific Ocean, and then there will be hurricane, they call typhoon in Asia, typhoon in Japan. So this is just an expression, however, that's not proven scientifically. It's just an expression, a butterfly effect. But the idea is there's a cause and effect. So the idea behind this metaphor, this idiom, is that there's a small input, butterfly flapping its wing, and it can create a huge result, large effect. It's like making a snowball. You start with a little snow, and then you roll and roll and roll, and it gets bigger to the point that you are not able to move. And then you make a big snowman, and then he will stay there until the spring. The butterfly flaps its wings in, let's say, in Ontario, and it will cause tornado or typhoon or hurricane in the Netherlands. Well, that's not likely to happen. Again, it's just an expression. But you think, when you hear that first time, you think, how does that work? Because those two things, butterfly and hurricane, and those two things in different locations, they seem to be very irrelevant. Very irrelevant. But let me try explain how that works in some situations. Not necessarily butterfly and typhoon, but let me explain that the one actual historical event that happened about a decade ago that I experienced in 2008, a CEO of a milk company in China, the CEOs were executed. The charge for faking milk. You might wonder, how can you fake milk, you ask? But they really did. So they put the artificial substance that can multiply protein, maybe 300%, that's what I heard. So we created artificial milk, and one infant or several infants drank it throughout China, and they died. And it was formula, it was terrible, and people were feared. And the government found out, and when in China, if you mess up with the food, and you get executed, that's what happened. So the question is, how did that happen? Why did they fake milk? Well, it began with a speech, one speech from one guy in the government, the Secretary of the State, making a very touching speech in front of all the comrades in China. He said, and I'm paraphrasing, he said, "It is my dream that all the people, all the little children in the People's Republic of China drink at least one peck of milk a day." After that speech, the government pushed the milk production, because there are so many people in China, as you know. I don't think they imposed a quota on the companies, but you never know with the communist countries. Some companies probably felt pressured to increase their products. They couldn't meet the quota, maybe company quota. So they faked, they made milk, and they got caught, and CEOs got executed. In the meantime, one of the surrounding countries, like South Korea and Japan, some pizza companies were having a hard time because they had to raise the pizza prices because the milk was not available, there was no cheese to put in the pizza, and some pizza companies got bankrupt. So here it is, one speech from a guy, CEOs got executed, some pizza companies went out of business, 50 million people in South Korea, they had to pay extra money for pizza, not that I'm complaining. The uncle, this is the worst part, there was one person, right, who owned the pizza company, pizza place, he went out of business, he killed himself. One speech from a guy, death of a person. That works. That's how it works. So the point is, unless somebody explains to you this complicated process, you would think, how on earth the butterfly flap have impact on someone else's death? Right? But when you explain it, now it makes sense. Now, why am I telling you? The book of Judges, the last three chapters work like that. Just a random person in Ephraim, a Levite, right? A priest. It didn't say a priest, but a Levite. He had one incident. He had a concubine. He was traveling. His concubine died. He complained, rightly so. And the war, civil war, Benjamites almost wiped out. They didn't have wives, men. There were no women. Now it seems like the tribe of Benjamin will be wiped out from the map of Israel. Now they're in trouble. So elders came and then discussed on this. And then the passage that we read is the solution that they gave. So why don't you guys snatch women when they have a party? So why am I telling you this? Well, Bible speaks of the cause and effect of current our misery. The scripture explains to us that it was caused by Adam and Eve a long time ago. That's what the Lord's Day 3 is echoing. People outside of church do not understand the connection between those two. What does current situation, the challenges, health issues, social problems, all sorts of problems and misery that I am experiencing, what do they have to do with Adam and Eve? Well, one man's disobedience, Romans 5, sin entered, sin spread, and one man's one act of disobedience, all human beings are plunged into misery and eternal damnation. Very far distance. Unless you explain that, you wouldn't get it. But that's how that is. So here are the theme and the points of the sermon. The disturbing story of finding wives for Benjamites. The background story, which extends from chapter 19. And the lesson that we can learn, which comes from the last verse of chapter 21. So, as I said, Judges 19 to 21, it is the one unit. A very good example showing how devastating our sin is. How this one flapping of butterfly wing, in this case, one sinful act of Levite or his concubine, can influence every aspect of everyone in the nation. Not only just individual, whole tribe, and whole nation. And at the end of the book, it tells a very depressing story of the Benjamites. Now, chronologically speaking, we should begin from the verse 19, but we'll go backwards. For instance, we read from chapter 21, 23, 24, it says, 200 Benjamite men captured 200 female dancers at Shiloh, took them as their wives. Why did that happen? as we read, because the elders of Israel gave them permission to do so. What they did was very shocking, you know. Pretty much they were just kidnapping young women and took them as their wives. Chapter 21:21, then the daughters of Shiloh came out to perform their dances and come out from the vineyard, and every man catch a wife for himself from the daughters of Shiloh, then go back to the land of Benjamin. Kidnapping. Actually, the word catch used here is the same word as that describes a lion hiding in the bush, hiding in the forest, ready to jump out, and as soon as there's the victim, he jumps out and to snatch the victim. Actually, this is the same word used in Psalm 10, verse 9. He lurks in the hiding place like a lion to catch the victim. So can you imagine? Let's say your daughter went to a campfire. So what was the recent event? A tamarack, right? And then at the end of campfire or tamarack, there's a talent night. There's a campfire. And then in the bush, there's some men hiding, jumps onto daughters and young ladies, and just took them and put them in the vehicle, minivan, whatever, and they took off just like that. That's what's happening here. The normal procedure would be you meet your father-in-law, you have extensive interview, you get his blessings, and then you go from there. That's how it's supposed to be. But there's none of that. There's no betrothal. We learned about that a few weeks ago. And the worst part is this. This was premeditated by the leaders of Israel, the elders of Israel. When their fathers and brothers come to the elders to complain, the elders say, "Oh, come on, be kind to them. They are about to be wiped out from Israel. We should be kind to them. We feel sorry for them because they were not able to get wives. Why is the tribe of Benjamin about to be extinct? Because according to chapter 20, if you read chapter 20, there is a war, civil war, between the whole Israel versus the tribe of Benjamin. Why was there battle between Benjamites and the whole Israel? Because Israel demanded deliverance of Gibeah, the members of people in Gibeah, into their hands so that they can execute them, they can punish them. Now we're going to backward from 21 to 19, okay? So why did Israel demand to hand over the people of Gibeah? Because the Israel received the fragments of woman's body. Somebody chopped off a woman, limb by limb, 12 pieces, and he sent her body throughout all the territory of Israel. Chapter 19, verse 29. Wow, the story gets worse and worse, isn't it? Making us very uncomfortable now. Actually, every story in this part is very, very should be uncomfortable. It's very uncomfortable and disturbing. So why did the man divide a woman's body into 12 pieces? Well, let me tell you. The woman was his wife. Actually, I should say, she's not really his wife. She was his concubine. It began with all little one story in chapter 19. Civil war, kidnapping women, premeditated kidnaps and all that. Goes all the way back to chapter 19, all the bloodshed, almost wiped out the Benjamites. Chapter 19 is, so to speak, one butterfly wing flap. Begins with the comment. Actually, chapter 19, if you look at chapter 19, it begins with the comment of the author. It says, "And it came to pass in those days when there was no king in Israel," and then goes into the story, "that there was a certain Levite staying in the remote mountains of Ephraim." Now, if you go back to the last verse of the book of Judges, it says, "In those days," it makes a conclusion by reintroducing what he said in the chapter 19, the beginning of the introduction. "In those days there was no king of Israel," and then everyone, everyone, which replaces the certain Levite, everyone did what was right in his own eyes. So when we read that, we should be able to see, I'm going to mention it later in the sermon too, that this Levite represents everyone of Israel in the time of Judges. There was a certain Levite in the mountain of Ephraim. Levite, one of the tribes, 12 tribes of Israel. Jacob had 12 sons. The Levites were set apart for special tasks. Priestly tribe, set apart. Only the tribe of Levi, the people of Levi, could do services in the temple. Only from the tribe of Levi alone came the priest. So this Levite, but look at this Levite, he took himself a concubine. Some young children might not know what concubine is, and understandably so. So concubine is like a wife, but she's not really a wife. There's a real wife, first wife, and there's another woman who lives with the man. So concubine lives with the man like a wife, but her status is lower than first wife. In history, kings had many concubines, but the wife, the queen, has more authority than other concubines. So when a man sleeps with the concubine and has sons or daughters, the sons and daughters, their status is also lower than the sons of daughters who were born of a first wife. So already, it already raises our eyebrows, a certain Levite in Ephraim who's supposed to devote his life for the service of the Lord has a concubine. Not even second wife, it doesn't say wife, which is also bad, but concubine. And the story gets worse. If you read through the chapter 19 later, you see concubine commits harlotry. Verse 2, his concubine played a harlotry against him and went away from him to her father's house at Bethlehem in Judah. Okay? So he visits his father-in-law to take her back. And he stays there, if you look at the story, for 3 days. And finally he leaves. He was on the way home. And he was going through near a place called Jebus. Jebusites, where the Jebusites were, which was Jerusalem. The servant at that time, Jerusalem was not part of Israel. It was ruled by the Jebusites. It was until the King David who conquered the Jerusalem, and then they became finally a part of Israel. So you can see there were foreigners. So servant, as they were going home, the servant suggested his master, "Let us turn aside. It's getting dark, master. So we should lodge in that area." But this Levite man says, "Well, we're not going to do that because this is a foreigner. We don't know who they are. But let us go to our people. Let us lodge in the place where the children of Israel dwells. We'll go to Gibeah." So you can see that this Levite, although he has a confidence in his own people. He has a confidence in that identity of the covenant people. So in his comment, you see there's a theological lesson that the God's people are supposed to be better. Right? So for instance, I remember my mom, whenever she had to fix her car or change tires, she would go to a shop owned by Christians. And then I realized that he is charging more than others. I mean, he's an honest man, but just he's using more expensive stuff. He was charging more than other stores, and I said, "My mom is you know, it's a free market. You should just go to other places." And then, but she had this mindset that Christians are always and supposed to be better than other people. They're honest. They're honest at least, and that should be, yes, because there's a belief that Christians are different. They are the ones who have religious convictions. They follow the commands of Christ. But sadly, that was not the case here. It's a big irony. In the time of Judges, this was a grave mistake, and we see at the end of chapter 19 and 20, he entered into the place called Gibeah, and there he met an old man. The old man took them into his house, and he warned them not to spend the night and in the open square, which kind of foreshadows what was going to happen. It's a very dangerous city, Gibeah, and the old man knew. He was a foreigner too. He came from somewhere else. Chapter 19, verse 22. Suddenly, and then the old man took them into his own house. And in chapter 19, 22, suddenly men from the city, perverted men, surrounded the house, beat the door. They spoke to the master of the house, which was the old man. And they said, "Bring out the man who came into your house, that we may know him carnally." So what are they saying here? The people, the mob. They were demanding the Levite so that they can have sex with him. In other words, the man of Gibeah wanted to rape the Levite. Not raping a woman, but the man, Levite. Very disturbing, very depressing. But that is recorded in the Bible. Doesn't it sound very similar to what happened in Sodom, right? When the angels visited Lot, the people demanded the same thing. The old man shouted, "Do not act so wickedly. Do not do this. Look, here's my virgin daughter and man's concubine. Let me bring them out to you. Humble them. Do with them as you please. But to this man, do not do such a vile thing." I don't know what to do with this comment, to be honest. Again, it's very disturbing, as you can see. The mob's demand is very disturbing, terrible enough. This old man's proposal, also very similar to Genesis 19 account, right? It's the Sodomites. Lot offered his two daughters to protect the guest. And it seems like maybe that was the practice in those days. We might wonder, how can you justify, even though it was custom? Let's say it was custom. How can you justify giving away your daughter and the concubine? She's not even your own. So my point is, I think this describes really, really well how depraved men are. Not how depraved men can be, men are. How depraved of mankind is. Inevitably, when the people are pushed to the edges, and inevitably creates some other collateral damage. Here, my daughters, just don't do this wicked thing. At least this is less evil. The man of Gibeah would not listen to the old man. Chapter 19, 25 says, "So the man took his concubine and brought her out to them." So the man took his concubine. So who is this man? Was the old man took the concubine out, or was the Levite? I guess it changes the tone depending who's bringing the person out. But at the end, either way, it is so bad. Either old man dragging the concubine out or Levite, it's still so bad. So they abused her all night until the morning. In the morning, at the door of the man's house, I was very surprised how detailed the depiction was. In the morning, at the door of the man's house, her master opened the door of the house and went out to go his way. And there was his concubine fallen at the door of the house with her hands on the threshold. What does that mean? Well, her hands on the threshold. Was she reaching out for help? Probably. Desperately. There was no help given. The old man, Levite, what were they doing inside? The text doesn't tell us, but we can imagine. Did they have a good night's sleep? If they did, it's pretty bad. Were they disturbed? Yeah, they should be. But they couldn't go out because people were so violent. So he said to her, "Get up, let us be going." She didn't respond. She's dead. She's dead. So the man took her to his house and he took a knife, divided her into 12 pieces, limb by limb, sent her throughout all the territories of Israel. Chapter 19, verse 12, 20. "And so it was that all who saw it said, 'No such deed has been done or seen from the day that the children of Israel came up from the land of Egypt until this day.'" Consider it, confer, and speak up. The story continues. Israel demanded justice. Benjamites refused to deliver the people of Gibeah. And they went to war, civil war. Benjamin, the tribe of Benjamin, lost. Only 600 men survived. 600 men. Everyone died. Pretty much wiped out. And then Israel felt sorry for them. Now what have we done? They are our brothers, one of the 12. The 600 men, no women survived. No children. Just 600 men. So what did they do? They arranged this scheme, this plan of kidnapping. That's how the story goes. So let's go to the second point, the lesson behind this kidnapping story. So we just saw how terrible people are, God's people, in the time of Judges, right? But let us look at first this story with the bird's eye view, not only from these three chapters, but whole book, to better get a better grip of this understanding of this book. You see, the book of Judges begins with the death of Joshua, right? Who was new Moses, who led the people of Israel into the promised land. And then the book begins with the death of Joshua. And Joshua died and he commanded Israel he repeats what the Lord said to him, to eliminate all the pagan people, pagan nations, pagan influence, everything. Because the pagan nations were so corrupt that what we see here in chapter 19 to 21 are pretty common among the pagan nations. A child sacrifice, rape, no morality, no rule, not so ever. So because they're so corrupt and depraved, because of evil practices, might influence the children of Israel who are supposed to be holy, from distinct from other nations, the Lord commanded the utter destruction of other inhabitants of the land. But people didn't do that. Chapters 1 and 2 tells us the failure of Israelites, how they failed to drive out the inhabitants of the land. The angel of the Lord in chapter 2 came from Gilgal to Bochim. Gilgal is a very important place when it comes to redemptive history. That there lies the 12 stones of which Joshua piled, 12 stones after 12 tribes of Israel. After crossing the Jordan, right, the water stopped. Ark of the Lord stayed there. Water stopped. They all crossed. And then Gilgal is the place they renewed their commitment to the covenant. It's the place that Joshua commanded all the males of Israel to be circumcised. Right? It's very important. As they removed their foreskin, they had to remove the dirty things in their hearts, in everyday activities. Circumcise your heart. Right, but in reality, after they went into the promised land, that didn't happen. The book of Judges talk about Israel's total failure. Judges chapters 3 to 16 tells a story about the leaders of Israel, the judges. In the beginning, the judges were okay. They were not that bad, but it was getting worse and worse. Some commentators describe it's a downward spiral, going down, getting worse and worse as the chapters continued, and then you can see that. Later, Samson shows many weaknesses, right? So terrible things like Gideon, Jephthah, Samson, all of them were so messed up. The Lord used them to deliver the people of Israel, but their life was not good. Now, people may say, well, the leaders are terrible. The leaders in the government, they are terrible. They are corrupt and so on. And the more power they get, they're likely to get corrupted. And that's right. That happens. But let's not stop at chapter 16. And if you continue chapter 17 to 23, what it says is that not only the leaders failed, but all of you failed. Every one of them. In those days, there was no king. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. So in this passage that we read, what looks at the first, nothing more than this personal crisis in the private household, you can see it escalates to the city, Gibeah, and then it becomes a crisis for entire tribe, and then ultimately entire nation of Israel gets into trouble, like a snowball, bigger and bigger, heavier and heavier, and that shows, no matter it's a sin of individual or king, whatever that is, it shows how powerful sin is, how devastating sin is. And that is the lesson. Powerful, devastating, personal-wise, city-wise, provincial-wise, national-wise, global-wise, whether it's a leader or common people, everyone is a sinful. Everyone does what is right in his own eyes. That's what it's saying here. The Lord's Day 3 rightly points out, we are so corrupt that we're always inclined to evil. And the Lord's Day 3 also ends with the gospel message, unless you're born again. So are we hopeless? Yes, with our own, yes. Unless you're born again, unless you're born of spirit, unless you believe in Jesus Christ, you will never have a hope. And then Book of Judges also ends with the gospel, which I'll talk about later. So the point is, from Book of Judges 1 to 16, the story of Judges, interesting, you notice that chapter 1 to 16, when it talks about leaders, you know all the names, because it tells you the name. But notice that chapter 17 to 21, the characters are nameless. And this is very intentional. It does not mean that this story is historically inaccurate. No. This terrible thing that we read really happened in history. It really did. Then why are they nameless? Well, one commentator gave a really helpful comment that he said something about twofold significance to the namelessness of the characters, these principal characters. The key is in the comment, the opening comment and the last comment of Book of Judges, chapter 21. In those days, there was no king. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. So this nameless Levite represents every Levite. Concubine, this nameless concubine, every woman, the father-in-law who asked him to stay, every host, old man residing in Bethel, everyone, everyone outside of Benjamin town reflects everyone. Everyone did as he saw fit. Every host was capable of committing unspeakable crime, which Benjamites did. Every guest could be victim, mistreated, even raped. Every woman was potential victim of violent crime. Isn't that true? today, especially in city, in some places in the world, or even North America. I remember traveling in one particular city in China. I stayed there for 2 months. It's a beautiful city, nevertheless. And that city, after 8 p.m. in the evening, you see every store closes doors. The lights off, it's dead silent, very dark. It's a thriving city, but after 8, everything closes. Which was very contrary to where I lived in another place in Chongqing. It's called Chongqing, it's a different place. This particular city was very scary. Why? Because in certain section of city, terrible crimes like rape and murder, kidnapping happens at least once a week. Or every day. Well, don't get me wrong, not every city was like this. But this particular one was pretty bad. So the missionary that we stayed with, that he gave us warning, don't go outside of city at night. Just don't do it, especially if you're a woman. So you can see there's no rule, or there's no law. There were law enforcement, but there was not much public security. There was a chaos, anarchy. The book of Judges, chronologically speaking, Joshua, Judges, and then chronologically speaking, book of Ruth, and then 1 Samuel, right? Notice the location of the book of Judges. It's right between Joshua and 1 Samuel, or Ruth. The significance of the book that comes after, Book of Ruth, is that she is a grandma, great-grandma of King David. There's this anticipation of king. There's this anticipation of king throughout the Book of Judges, Book of Ruth, and especially 1 Samuel. However, let me tell you, having a king in the 1 Samuel didn't solve the problem. King Saul, the first king, at the beginning he was a very humble man. He did many good things. He led people to war and he won victory by the help of the Lord. He was filled with the Spirit, but later he became corrupt. King David, he was a good king. He was not perfect though. He committed some serious sins. At the end of his life, he had a censor, right? He counted the people, numbered the people, and many people died because of that. King Solomon, his son, was a wise king, but his heart was not like before. At the end, he served other gods. So once again, this comment: in those days, there was no king. That's why these things are happening. Raping, civil war, killing all the people, massacre, and then now they feel sorry, and then you can kidnap the daughters. All those incredible things are happening because there was no king in Israel. But again, king would not necessarily solve the problem. Human king cannot solve the problem. Why? Because the problem lies in our hearts. Sin, the problem of sin, which gives so much trouble, which grows like a snowball, which has a tremendous amount of effect on personal life, community, society, in our nation, can be solved by the true king. So in a redemptive, this short amount of time period between Judges and 1 Samuel, of course, the immediate fulfillment of this prophecy, if you want to call it anticipation, we need a king, is obviously King David. But throughout the Old Testament and the New Testament, this refers to the true king, Jesus Christ. only when the true King Jesus Christ comes, all these terrible things that are happening even now will stop. Indeed, the true King, the Christ, he did solve the problem of sin by giving himself to the punishment, for the punishment, our punishment, on the cross. He, through his payment, he betrothed us to himself. He took us to himself. He makes us faithful to him. You notice that I made a comment before that you can see throughout these chapters how powerful, how devastating a sin is. Yet we have to remember the Christ is much more powerful, that he can solve the problems. And he did, by his death and the resurrection. And then Philippians 2 rightly calls that his name should be glorified above all the names. There's his exalted name, Christ Lord. He's the King of Kings. It's something that we can remember, especially this time that we have election, that do not put your trust in men, but in the Lord. Praise be the Lord.